Ahoy, mateys! Welcome to the GameBuoy.org video game podcast, your twice-monthly port of call for gaming news and views that maybe aren't on your radar, but most definitely should be. I'm your host, Captain Spike, and with me, as always, is First Mate Slagkick.
Yarr!
Today is August 31st, 2013, and this is episode 36, Version Revision. You may be aware, we recorded just last night, in fact... A GameBuoy Micro.
GameBuoy Micro.
Are we going to do that for this, too?
It's a GameBuoy thing, yes.
Well, all right, then. So we recorded a GameBuoy Micro.
GameBuoy Micro.
Girl. On the Kingdom Hearts series. Of course, if you're a fan, like I am, I would wholeheartedly recommend you go check that out. And for those of you that already are not fans of Kingdom Hearts, we did keep it spoiler-free. So that if you're looking for an introduction to the series before hopping in on HD 1.5 Remix, now would be the time to do so.
Remix. Not remix. Remix.
And, you know, following up on the whole, you know, twice-monthly port of call bit, even though we are recording this episode in August, it is going to go up on our feed in September. So by the time you're listening to it, it will be September, and this is our first episode of that month.
Twice-monthly port of call.
Anyway, this week, following Nintendo's surprising announcement of the 2DS, First Mate Slagkick suggested we take a look at the history of console revisions. And after how well his pitch for a Disney show was received last week, I had no choice but to concede. Is this a mutiny I smell?
No, actually, it's the Sonic Drive-In that we got for lunch.
Before we get to that discussion, though, we have a pretty full slate of our usual follow-ups and news bits. So, in the interest of your time and our own, let's get this party started.
So, Nintendo's Chibi-Robo photography game has been rated by the Australian Classification Board with the title Chibi-Robo, Let's Go Photo. Chibi-Robo, Let's Go Photo. And this game involves matching silhouettes in the game to real-life objects. I wonder how long it will take for someone to snap a picture of their junk.
Oh, so like if there's like a silhouette of like some scissors or something, it's like a long shaft with like a rounded end for the handles, and someone's like, hey, that looks like my junk and balls.
Might as well use my junk.
And balls.
Junk and balls. We don't have a North American official announcement yet, but...
But these classifications typically end up in yeah. Something, so...
We got a little bit of an update about the game that is unofficially being called Yakuza Restoration, because I don't know the Japanese title. We know what happens when I try to
think Japanese. Ryugagatoku Isen? Isen?
Yes, that. It'll be a little bit more like an RPG, but it has plenty of weapons, so it'll be interesting. You know, we still don't have any announcement of what console it's for, although, I mean, PS4, Xbox One makes sense, although maybe Wii U. You never know.
Well, you know, on that point, there has been, you know, the Yakuza HD 1 and 2 remakes for Wii U, so it really is, you know, anybody's game at this point. I'm hoping it comes out still, like I said last week, you know, on the PS3 and Vita, and or Vita, so that I can import it. This sounds great, a Yakuza game with, like, more RPG elements and stats and stuff. I'm here for that.
Hashtag here for that. Nipponichi was talking with Dengeki PlayStation... And said that, you know, they want to balance sequels and new games, and that PS3 is still their focus, but they'll also be mixing in Vita and PS4 releases.
That's interesting.
And it kind of came about because they were talking about how retailers are reordering one of their new IP called The Witch and the Hundred Knight. Speaking of which, The Witch and the Hundred Knight is coming to the U.S. and Europe in early 2014.
Indeed, the official title is, in fact, The Witch and the Hundred Knight.
Yep.
Knight is not plural in this context, although we are still talking about knights like, you know, knights and dragons, not knights like Into Dreams.
Yeah, and the lead character Metallica has had name change to Metalia because, you know, she couldn't be named Metallica probably because something something Lars Ulrich.
I was just going to say, Lars Ulrich gonna sue your ass.
And the Hundred Knight will help her spread her swamp through the land of Medea. So I wonder if Tyler Perry has a role in this. So that sounds really fun. You know, we love Nipponichi, so yay!
You know, we've long known that Ace Attorney 5 was coming to the U.S. as a downloadable-only eShop game for 3DS. What we now know is that Ace Attorney 5 Dual Destinies is going to carry a price point of $30. This is,
that's a lot of money.
Well, I was just going to say, this is, of course, $10 less than the average 3DS launch price point in this day and age. So we're getting a little bit of a deal for it being a download-only game.
Yep, and from these screenshots, we can see that Apollo Justice has a really fierce bracelet that, like, is magically reacting to stuff, presumably.
In other news, Square Enix has temporarily halted digital sales of Final Fantasy XIV, A Realm Reborn, after stronger-than-expected audiences have turned out to play this game. I'm certainly very happy that this game is so popular and that everyone is trying to play it, everyone and their mama, but it's very unfortunate that anytime you're trying to log in, you have to, you know, sort of spam the server with logins to get on.
Yep, I know a lot of people who are very QQ about that right now.
Yeah, it's a thing that a lot of people are QQ about. I will say for myself, I've never had trouble getting in after more than a minute or two of spamming logon. Like, it's gone well for me. But, I mean, certainly, you know, it sucks that things are like this. Either way, by the time you hear this episode, very likely these server issues and kinks will be worked out. They're currently saying early to mid-week of this coming week is when they're adding new hardware to sort of deal with sort of this stronger-than-expected interest in their game.
And speaking of hardware in Final Fantasy XIV, but not in the way that Captain Spike was talking about, Final Fantasy XIV and Realm Reborn will be coming to PlayStation 4 sooner than you expect. You know, they don't say when in 2014 it's going to be out, but Naoki Yoshida-san, who is the producer of A Realm Reborn, was saying that, you know, they're really working on trying to get a transfer service in place for when it's ready on the PS4 so that it can be a smooth transition. And, you know, they can get people playing the PS3 version now, and then when they get PS4, be able to pick it right up, so that sounds cool.
Yeah, that's great. You know, I will definitely be getting a PlayStation 4, as we've discussed here, and I already play and love Final Fantasy XIV. So yeah, I would totally buy this, and you know, as long as I can play with my same character across PC and PS4, I'm down. Like, I'm in like Flynn.
And you usually play, like, melee characters like
Yeah, my main is a pugilist, yeah. But he also does Lancer, because I'm working on getting him to Monk. In fact, I'm very nearly there, so.
So that sounds like a console, Realm Reborn would be great for you.
Yeah, you know, I actually play using the control pad even on my PC.
Oh, really?
It has just a really, just lovely interface for it. I'm really impressed with how they managed to make everything work.
That's great.
Yeah.
In other Square Enix news, Square Enix is going to be releasing a Dragon Quest X demo for the PC.
Wow, is it Square Enix MMO News Day?
Apparently. So starting on September 12th, you'll be able to download a demo.
You know, I have to tell you right now, I'm going to find an English patch for that demo, and I'm going to install it and play it in English and pretend that I'm playing the real full game in English, because that's going to be really sad that we don't get this over here.
Yeah, you know, something, Dragon Quest, no one cares about it in America.
Speaking of other online games, we have confirmation that Soul Calibur 2 HD Online, this, of course, is the 360 and PS3 downloadable game version of Soul Calibur 2. This game is going to include the PlayStation 2 and original Xbox, I almost called it Xbox One, Xbox... secret characters from, well, secret, guest characters from Soul Calibur 2. That is Spawn from, of course, the Spawn comics, and Heihachi from Tekken.
Awesome!
Yeah, it's something. I'm still holding out hopes for a Wii U version to get, you know, Link.
We'll see. In J-Star's Victory Versus news, we've had three more characters unveiled. Sasuke from Naruto, Vegeta from Dragon Ball Z,
get it done!
And Zebra from Toriko. So, that roster's growing?
Yeah, no, I'm really, 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 really excited for that game.
Yep.
And last, but certainly not least, in our follow-ups, we have news that Capcom and Nintendo will be announcing a collaboration of some kind in Japan on September 14th.
The Silicon Era article talks about Monster Hunter, Monster Hunter, Monster Hunter 4.
Yeah, well, that's actually, I think the reason is that Monster Hunter 4 in Japan comes out on September 14th. So the idea of Nintendo doing a direct that day to announce something, like, a lot of people think it's probably going to be related to Monster Hunter.
Monster Hunter Direct.
Monster Hunter Direct. That would be cool, but also interesting.
Too bad it's not going to be a Mega Man Direct.
Well, you know, they usually don't do directs on the day that a game comes out, so I think that's why people are like, maybe Monster Hunter, but maybe not. I'm kind of hoping for the Monster Hunter Hunter in Melee, or Smash Brothers. I'd be here for that.
That'd be awesome.
Or like an assist trophy of like a Kuropeko or something.
That'd be cute.
Yeah, it'd be pretty rad.
And then like one of the things that you can use as like a weapon thing would be like some of the monsters come out, like a Pokeball thing.
Well, that's exactly what I was thinking of in terms of an assist trophy.
Oh, I thought you meant those little cute things. You know, the little cute things that are like the mascots for Monster Hunter. Anyway, that's it for our follow-ups, and now it is time to, like, oh my god, totally move on to
news. 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 Oh my god, news.
What the hell is wrong with you, girl?
Square Enix has announced an expanded version of Bravely Default Flying Fairy called Bravely Default for the sequel.
Womp womp.
It's gonna have new story events, new controls, three slave slots. Three save slots.
And I'm a slave for you.
And addition to the battle system, so that battle speed will be up to 4 times faster.
Yeah, you know, this is really exciting. This is gonna be both a standalone release in Japan, December 5th for, you know, like $50. But they're also releasing it as DLC to the original release. Which, I mean, I guess I don't really know how that works with adding save slots and stuff, but.
What's up with us and slave slots?
Yeah, like, I don't know.
We're like,
but
hey,
the DLC
daddy.
Version is gonna be like $30. So this is, you know, it's super interesting. We don't know yet if this is the version that we're gonna be getting localized here in the US in 2014.
It's not fair that they're already getting more Bravely Default content, and we don't even have it yet.
But long-term, if nothing else, I suspect we'll at least get the DLC for it down the line. And hopefully at a more agreeable price point than $30. That's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money.
Moving on.
So Microsoft and Level 5 will be besties for the first time in a long time, because they will be releasing Wonderflick on the Xbox One, as well as the PS4, Wii U, Vita, and PS3. Microsoft and Level 5 have not worked together since True Fantasy Live Online, and then that got canceled, and then they weren't really besties anymore.
Yeah, you know, to me, the real takeaway about this news, this game is, you know, it's going to be on Xbox One, PS4, Wii U, Vita, and PS3, and on all of these other platforms that aren't Wii U, you need, like, a tablet or a Vita or something to act
Smart
as your
glass.
Second screen. But for Wii U, it's just going to use the gamepad for your second screen. So, to me, this sounds like the Wii U version might be the definitive version.
Yes.
This, of course, is a JRPG. Akihiko Hino-san is going to be designing the title, and now Ikeda is going to be doing art along with Nobuo Uematsu doing music.
Oh.
So this is actually,
snap.
Yeah, it's actually quite a collaboration. I'm really excited for this game. You know, obviously I'm always here for JRPGs. I'm a big fan of Level 5. This is just an absolute joy to hear.
Speaking of Level 5, they have announced the next installment in the Professor Layton series.
Oh yeah, and this is quite a coup.
It is Layton 7, which is for 3DS, iOS, and Android. It is a role-play puzzle.
Yeah, it's not a puzzle game in the same way that the other Layton games have been, which have been straight up like riddle games and word games and stuff. Like, this is straight up like a JRPG, basically, with puzzle elements. You know, obviously a part of the big deal is that it's gonna be on smartphones as well as 3DS. So, stay tuned for more information here. Sort of interesting things are afoot at Circle K.
There is a new Persona 4 project that is coming. It is Persona 4 the Slot.
Trollolololololol.
It's a slot machine.
Basically, the new, you know, the new Persona 4 game is a patchy slot game.
Is it canon?
I mean, I would assume not, but, like, how awful is this? Like, I am not Smiles Time about this, I have to tell you.
Are you going to be Smiles Time about the fact that the Kingdom Fighters Online MOBA is going into beta next month?
Not exactly. I mean, it's cool that that exists.
But
and
it's in Thailand, so sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, I like MOBAs well enough, but if this doesn't come out here, I'm not going to get that excited about it. Like, I'm not going to do some crazy, like, IP masking or tunneling or some BS to play it. Like, you know, it's not Dragon Quest Online.
So, Aqua Plus is hoping to bring their Two Hearts 2 spinoff, Two Hearts 2 Dungeon Travelers, which took the dating sim girls and put them into a dungeon RPG. It was originally on PSP in 2011. They are working on making a Vita remake.
You know, that's interesting because I'm not super familiar with the Two Heart franchise, and it sounds to me like if this game comes to the U.S., I don't know that it will, but if it does, this would probably be a good way to sort of get into it. And I'd really like to get to know these characters before I play Aquapazza.
Exactly, yeah. In other Final Fantasy 14 news, as per earlier, they are planning to push out major updates every 3 months, and PvP is on its way.
I'm really excited about this. You know, a lot of people have been talking about how Final Fantasy 14 should be a free-to-play game. It shouldn't have a monthly fee, like, sub-games are on their way out. But to me, if they can actually do big, meaningful content updates every 3 months, that would go a long way to sort of justifying the sub-cost.
True.
So, fingers crossed, I hope this works out. You know, they've been pumping out content for, like, what, like 10-plus years now for Final Fantasy XI. And while I don't know that they've ever hit as often as every three months, certainly they have kept their word on supporting that game with additional content, and if they say that they can do this for 14, I'm here for it. I hope that works out for sure.
I feel like you need to take this one because it's like a baby of yours.
It is. Some fans, specifically a coder who calls himself Mr. Anon, using a homebrew fighting game engine for the Virtual Boy, he's made a version of Street Fighter II Hyper Fighting Edition to play on the Virtual Boy. Currently, this ROM does not work on Virtual Boy emulators, but if you put it onto a Virtual Boy flash cart, which is apparently a thing, you can apparently download it right now and play Street Fighter II on a Virtual Boy.
So you're going to be doing that, yes?
I have already priced flashcards. Like, I need to do this. I am literally looking at my Virtual Boy right now. It's right here. I love it so, so much. And
aren't you going to get a migraine?
This rude bitch.
It's not me. I'm using, like, the fake douche voice.
Yeah, right? Well, 3D causes headaches, didn't you know?
It does for me. Guild Wars 2.
Maybe you need to get stronger eyes. Sorry about it.
Guild Wars 2 is bringing back the Super Adventure Box.
Yay!
World 2 will be available next week.
Oh, man, that's awesome. When does it go up?
Next week. Oh, September 3rd. I'm sorry.
Excellent. So by the time you're listening to this episode, it very well may be up.
I should reinstall Guild Wars 2.
You should. It's great fun. And especially, you know, the last retro dungeon they had was so cool. I expect that this one is going to be even better.
I'd really just love to see ArenaNet make just a little retro-style game in this style, because it just gets such a good response from the Guild Wars 2 community. And super exciting news, Just Dance Kids 2014 will be grooving its way to retail this October.
October 22nd, 2013. Don't let that title fool you.
Yes, and it'll include songs like Hit the Lights by Selena Gomez in the Scene, Give Your Heart a Break by Demi Lovato, One Thing by One Direction, The Freeze Game by Yo Gabba Gabba, and also the Fraggle Rock theme.
It's also going to have Walking on Sunshine, which I thought that you would really appreciate that.
I do.
It also is going to have Fireflies, which I'm hoping is the Owl City song. It doesn't list in this PR, but I'm hoping.
Presumably.
Yeah, I'm being facetious. I don't like Owl City.
Who does?
You know, I say that, but I've seen them live. That kid is kind of adorable, so, you know, that's something.
And he did a Wreck-It Ralph song, so, eh.
You know,
and he did a song with Carly Rae Jepsen.
Anyway, in rather depressing news, Beautiful Joe is returning to games.
Yay!
As a guest character in an iOS social brawler game.
Oh.
The game is called Combo Crew, and it will be receiving an update soon to add Beautiful Joe to the roster. Please look forward to it.
Also coming back, for the first time in years, is Namco Bandai's stretchy hero, Bravo Man. This is also an iOS Android game. It's an endless runner called Bravo Man Binja Bash.
That's exciting. And it's free, so you should probably look it up and just play it, because it's free.
Yep.
Anything else to say about Bravo Man?
Bravo.
All right, man. So, Nintendo, rather strangely, earlier this week, put out a series of press releases that sort of shocked the nation. By which, of course, I mean shocked people who play games. And basically just announcing a bunch of really unexpected stuff, sort of just randomly in the middle of the week. So, the most notable and the big takeaway here, and I'm just going to cut right to the chase, is that the Wii U Deluxe is getting a price cut. This previously retailed for $349.99, now it's going to retail for $299.99.
Which is the same price as the regular one.
Well, as the basic one, yes. So obviously the recurring theory is that the basic is on its way out because it's basic.
Yep.
Nintendo has confirmed that they have no plans at this time for a Wii U ambassador program. You may recall a couple of years back when the 3DS price dropped rather rapidly after its initial launch. Nintendo did the ambassador program. We talked about this here on the show, I'm pretty sure. Sort of giving, you know, basically free content to early adopters so that they wouldn't feel ripped off for buying their consoles before the price drop.
Yeah.
So people were hoping that when the Wii U price dropped, that we would get an ambassador program, and sadly, that's not the case. I'm not too worried about it. I love my Wii U. I can't wait for Wonderful 101. But certainly, I would not have said no to free content.
Yep. So we got some interesting news about Wind Waker HD. It'll be available a couple weeks early on September 20th as an eShop download. If you want to wait for the retail copy, that'll be October 4th. And if you want to pay $5 extra, you can get it at GameStop with a Ganondorf figure. Which, and honestly, I don't like supporting GameStop, but I love Wind Waker, and Ganondorf's design in Wind Waker is so awesome.
And, you know, fairly noteworthy is that this game is going to be retailing for $49.99 on the eShop and the non-GameStop Limited Edition.
Yep.
The GameStop Limited Edition, which, as Sidekick said, was $5 more, is going to be $54.99.
Yep, and if you want to check out the Silicon Era article, they also have some release date info for some of the upcoming first-party titles.
We have Wii Party U coming on October 25th. We have Super Mario 3D World coming on November 22nd. And Donkey Kong Country Tropical Freeze slated for December 6th.
I just remembered, we had people suggest Tropical Freeze recipes for us, and we never tried it. We might have to do that for the holiday season.
Yeah, definitely. We will do that for our December 1 episode.
And then also slated for release this holiday season are Wii Fit U and Mario and Sonic at the Sochi Homophobic 2014 Olympic Winter Games, which you should protest because Russia is terrible to queer individuals.
Yeah, I'm going to have a really hard time with that because I really like sports a lot and I like watching sports a lot, but also I don't want to support all that.
Well, good thing that the Sonic Olympic Games are kind of a mess.
Yeah, supposedly some of them are pretty alright. I don't know, I haven't put a lot of time into them.
So we have some Zelda A Link Between Worlds.
Oh, nobody's interested in Zelda. We can just skip that.
So, it will be available on November 22nd, along with Mario Party Island Tour, which is the 3DS
Mario Party.
So two great games for 3DS on
November 22nd.
Right in time for the Thanksgiving holidays.
Yeah, in fact, you know, I'll almost certainly buy both of these, and then when people come over for Thanksgiving turkeys and stuff,
we'll have a Mario Party.
We'll have a Mario Party party.
Mario Party party party. Party party party.
Stop doing what you're doing. And last, but certainly not least, as it is literally the reason why we're recording this episode today, Nintendo also stealth announced the Nintendo 2DS. This is a budget 3DS that only plays games in 2D. It's going to be launching on October 12th, which, of course,
listeners are notable.
Attentive listeners will likely note is the same day as Pokemon X and Pokemon Y hit. The 2DS is going to retail for $129.99, which puts it at, you know, like $40 cheaper than the regular DS.
3DS.
3DS, yes. And like $70 cheaper than the XL.
3DS XL, yeah.
So
three pricing points.
Yeah, you know, it makes a lot of sense to me to put something like that out on the same day as Pokemon.
But 2DS, really? How many 3DSs and DSs and everything have there been, Captain Spike? It's been so many. Oh, my God. Revisions. Oh, my God.
You're being facetious, right? Because, like, I literally can't with you right now.
I am being facetious. I was trying to segue into our discussion, which is hardware revisions, because... You know, the kind of the joke is, oh, consoles these days, like, are always getting hardware revisions, and LOL, 27 PlayStation 3 SKUs. But, let's be real, this has been something that's kind of been a fact of life for consoles for a very long time, and handhelds.
Well, yeah, and yeah, we're in the discussion now. you know, even as far back as the Atari, the Commodore 64, you would have multiple... hardware configurations of these things at the retail point of sale. Obviously, in particular with regard to the Atari, there was a lot of brand confusion about, like, oh, can this Atari system use this game software? So it's not really something new.
Yeah, and not only did the Atari, you know, of course, have the 2600 and the 5200, but then even within the 2600, there was, like, the Sears, like, video system, or what was it called? It was, like, this... I think it was, like, Sears video system. I don't know. That was before my time. Were you old enough to really remember, like, the 2600 and then the 5200 coming out and...
Yeah, I remember these things. I had multiple Ataris growing up. I guess my parents started me in this whole collector's thing at a young age. I still have literally like a trash bag full of Atari cartridges. So I remember all of this. And again, for me, the thing I remember as a kid was looking at all of the boxes of games I couldn't play because I didn't have the right Atari.
Oh.
So for me, that's where this comes in, and, you know, I expect to some degree that people probably look at the Atari situation as more analogous to sort of, like, the PS1 to the PS2, rather than, you know, a Play It Loud Game Boy to a Game Boy Pocket. But, to me, because these things all came out in such a relatively quick time scale, like, you know, it was not a long period of time between these things. I really feel more like they're just revisions, especially since most of them could play games for the device before them, but not the device after them.
Right. So, I mean, there's a little bit of, like, backwards compatibility, like, very early on being introduced. And, but also this kind of, had a bit of a factor along with all the, you know, shit games that we talked about in our shit games episode, to kind of contribute to the downfall of the video game market in 83, right?
I would absolutely make that argument, yes. I do believe that you saying that would be an absolutely valid thing.
And how about Commodore 64? I know when I think of Commodore 64, I think of Rob Roberts from Orange Lounge Radio.
You know, it's funny you say that because I was just going to say, I did have a Commodore 64. I still do in that closet right behind you somewhere in one of those boxes. But... I haven't touched it in at least 10 years at this point. I certainly don't really remember what the retail environment was like for the Commodore 64. I just remember that when my mother bought that one, which, funny enough, she had intended to use as a word processor. Fat chance at that. I do recall there being some confusion about which model to buy. Like, they were all basically the same, but with different options, you know, maybe different RAM sizes or something, IDK.
Looks like, I'm actually looking it up, it looks like a lot of the hardware revisions were based on motherboard revisions.
Oh, okay, that's interesting.
And something that's interesting is that if you, this is not really related to hardware revisions, but if your Commodore 64, the case, plastic case, is kind of like discolored over time, there is a public domain chemical mist called Retrobrite.
Wait, what is that? Does that work on, like, Super Nintendos? Because I was just complaining to one of the guys over from Koopa Club this week about how my Super Nintendo plastic is all, like, gross-colored because my parents are both smokers.
If it's ABS plastic, then yes, it will work.
Oh, girl. You know, I actually still have my Super Nintendo out in this box right here. Why don't you just talk on the show for a minute while I get it out of this box to show you?
Okay, well, Retrobrite is made from a hydrogen peroxide solution, a UV lamp, and tetraacetylethylenediamine laundry booster, which has nothing to do with hardware revisions, but we need to...
So this is the color it should be, and then yeah. This is the color the rest of it is.
Well, yes, that does look like some of the yellowing we're seeing with this Commodore 64 on this Wikipedia article. But anyways, enough about public domain chemical mixes. Let's get moving back.
I didn't even know public domain chemical mixes were
That's
a thing.
That's kind of why I wanted to mention it, because what? So anyway, you know, we talk about, oh, there were revisions for Atari and Commodore 64, but when did it really start, Captain Spike?
You know, I would, in truth, if I really had to peg down when the games industry really went whole hog into this sort of era, habit, however you want to phrase it, of rehashing their hardware, revising it, re-releasing it, adding features. I would look at Nintendo's Game Boy. Of course, I'm sure you all remember the big hunky piece of plastic that was
Ooh,
the original Game
so
Boy.
So hunky.
But what many more of you might remember from there, of course, was the Play It Loud Game Boys, which were all different colors. My understanding is that they are basically functionally the same. We then had, you know, the Game Boy Pocket. We had the Game Boy Pocket Lite in Japan. We had the Game Boy Color. There may or may not have been some lit versions of the Game Boy Color. I'm having a really hard time finding information about that, although I feel quite certain I read about it in an issue of EGM at some point.
You know, the interesting thing about Game Boy Color is that, like, we think of it as a revision, but, I mean, in some ways, it's also was a brand new handheld. So, but, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, a lot of people don't realize this, but depending on the color of the cartridge for your Game Boy Color, some of the color games could be played on the regular Game Boys. So, you know, there was certain, like, even though, oh, this is a Game Boy Color game, it was still, it's not just a straight up, oh, this is a DS that can play your GBA games. Like, there was a little more cross-pollination, I guess, if you want to say.
You know, for me, a big part of why I don't really think about that, like, why I just think of the Game Boy Color as a revision of the Game Boy and the Game Boy Pocket, is that it didn't have a lot of software support for exclusive Game Boy Color games, which, you know, is sort of exactly what you're talking about. Of course, there was stuff like the Super Mario Bros. DX and Link's Awakening DX. But for the most part, I would say the majority of those games were not color exclusive.
Right, right. Even if they carried the Game Boy Color branding, you know, so,
So that's, to me, why, you know, in terms of how we're looking at this, it's more of an iteration of the Game Boy than the Game Boy Advance, which was itself, like, to me, a new platform altogether.
Right, right. And, you know, the black-colored cartridges are usually the ones that would, even though being a Game Boy Color design game, would still play. And
something like Killer Instinct or what have you.
Pokemon Gold and Silver actually could be played on an original Game Boy. I didn't really think about that at the time, because, of course, I had a Game Boy Color, you know, right away. So.
Of course you did, girl.
But, I mean, that's interesting that, you know, a lot of people maybe at the time didn't realize that. And were like, oh, it says Game Boy Color. I need to buy a Game Boy Color. So I kind of feel like the fact that a lot of these games were backwards compatible despite being designed for Game Boy Color was not really something that was talked about. I mean, I guess in a way that's kind of shady, but, you know, it kind of really points to it more being a revision than a brand new console, you know? Like you said, with the GBA.
Yeah, that's really how, that's really where I come to lay on this whole point, is really the idea that it was treated less of a new platform and just more of, oh, a new configuration of this existing platform that has additional features.
You know, the funny thing for me as a kid growing up was that I never thought, oh, another Game Boy. I was like, oh, I want that one. Oh, I want that really cool Game Boy Pocket. Oh, I want the see-through one, you know? So, did you just load up your Game Boy Color?
It's a Game Boy Pocket, actually, but...
Oh. That's making me think of my musical that I'm working on.
I thought that it might.
Anyway, one of the things that I remember as a kid with these Game Boys coming out, like I said, was that I never really thought it was oversaturation of the market. I just was like, oh, cool. Like, the revisions just made sense, you know? I mean, like, the Pocket was lighter. I didn't have a Pocket, but I, of course, did have a Color. And, you know, they just made sense.
They just made sense. I strongly agree there. Some of the Play It Loud stuff was a little silly. Like, I don't really need a clear plastic, fat, huge original
Except
Game Boy.
It looked really cool. It looked really cool.
I don't think it looked that
cool.
You
could see its guts.
Nickelodeon guts!
So, yeah, Game Boy definitely was kind of that's what started the trend. But one thing I remember really well is when the NES revision came out, the top-loading NES, and it came with, like, kind of the bone controller.
The bone!
The bone! But, you know, the bone controller.
Oh, like, my gosh, I'm looking at Play It Loud Game Boy Clears, and I can find one on eBay for $22, and I might buy it right now.
That's not bad at all.
I'm sorry, continue.
That's not a lot of money. No, I was saying that I remember it was, like, you know, after the SNES had been released, seeing that that top-loading NES in the stores. I think it was, like, Kmart, to be exact. So
it's like Woolworths.
Ah! Maybe out of Babbage's.
Software, et cetera, my friend.
Oh, dear. But was that the NES 101? Yeah, the NES 101. And, you know, it was sold with the lower price point. You know, they really just were trying to kind of push it later in the console's lifespan. And it, you know, kind of looked more like a Super Nintendo. The controller was the dog bone. The bone! And, you know, they were really just trying to be like, oh, NES is still alive. One thing that was interesting about the NES 101, which was the top loader, is that they got rid of the 10NES authentication chip. And because there was... Do you remember the blinking power light problem?
Oh, I most certainly
yeah,
do.
I think everyone had an issue with that sometimes. Taking out the 10NES authentication chip helped alleviate that problem, but also allowed you to play unlicensed games.
Oh, Tengen Tetris, here we come!
Oh, yes, so, that's, kind of, I don't know if I would say it's the definitive NES, because, you know, it's only an RF connection.
Yeah,
There's no composite video jacks.
I still use my old one, whatever model that's referred to, I don't know.
The NES 001?
Sure, I've always just called it the one with the weird springy bit.
Springy bit?
Yeah, because it slides down, like you put the game in place.
Oh, yeah, yeah, you know, classic NES, yeah.
Yeah, although sometimes I just use my, my Game Genie with it. Not to use cheat codes or anything, but because I feel like I have, fewer issues running it that way. Which is probably actually not that uncommon now that I think about it. I feel like that springy bit mechanism probably gets in the way of a lot of things.
And, you know, one thing that was interesting about the Famicom version of this revision was that it looked pretty much identical to the, I mean, more or less. There were a few subtle differences, but it looked pretty much the same as this NES 101.
Well, and that's a big difference because the original Famicom and the original NES, like, they look nothing alike.
Exactly.
Like,
they're, like, very different. The Famicom,
well, the Famicom
has
literally
wired controllers. One of them had a microphone so that you could blow into it or make a noise and get rid of the Pole's voice in Zelda.
Well, you know, in Japan, it was very much sold as, like, a family entertainment unit. Like, oh, this is something that the children can use as well. Whereas in North America, the NES was very specifically designed to look more like a VCR or like a piece of entertainment equipment because they wanted to, you know, the market had crashed and Nintendo was trying very hard to bring a more sophisticated
entertainment system.
Well, exactly so. So to me, it's interesting that despite the Famicom and the NES looking so different, upon revision, they basically went with a very, very similar sort of falling into line look. Across the designs.
Yes, I mean, that's also something interesting to think about as we're looking at this early era of consoles is the, you know, differences between the Japanese and Western releases. There were a couple other Famicoms over in Japan. There was a Famicom titler or Famicom editor, which was put out by Sharp Corporation in 1989. And it was kind of notable because it had S-video output, which really allowed it to be, you know, very clear image, and had a subtitle generator and, like, let you create gameplay videos and demos. So that's really kind of neat.
Yeah, that's awesome. That sounds like the ideal sort of Let's Play machine.
Yeah, it was 43,000 yen. So that translates to about, I mean, that was back then, so I don't know what that would translate to.
We don't have a Game Buoy Extra anymore, or this week, do we? Game Buoy Extra, tweet at us if you would watch a Game Buoy-branded Let's Play series.
We've
hashtag Game Buoy Extra.
Are you suggesting that we get a Famicom titler?
Maybe. I like buying weird stuff.
And one thing I remember was the what is called the Nintendo M82, which was, do you remember in the stores? It's basically, it's a demo unit where you could have, it had 12 cartridges.
Does
inside.
It play Midnight City?
That's M83.
Oh, my bad.
The M82 was basically just a demo unit that you would see in stores that would be numbered. And you could select it. And for some reason, I was like, I always wanted it because I was like, oh, it's an NES jukebox.
Hey, I remember seeing pictures of that in magazines. I never really saw one IRL.
I remember seeing a few IRL. But anyways, that's really all I think of for the NES. But the Super NES, I definitely remember the revision, which was officially code. The official code for it was the SNES 101, kind of like the NES 101. Because that one was, you know, a lot more streamlined. It was smaller. It wasn't the big bulky block that, you know, the original Super Nintendo was. And that was actually the one I got because I was a little bit late to the SNES. So it, you know, was a lot more compact. But, you know, still pretty much the same. It didn't have the expansion slot, so you couldn't have the Satellaview, but let's be real, who had a Satellaview outside of Japan?
Well,
nobody.
I mean, no one. That's the point.
And there's also, you know, it only did composite video instead of composite S-video and RGB outputs.
You say that word really funny.
What?
Nothing, just keep going.
Also, a slight redesign to the controller, but still pretty much, you know, functionally the same, aside for those little bits of changes. The Famicom, Super Famicom, also got a revision that was again very similar, like the Famicom revision. So it was, they were kind of similar to each other. This was called the Super Famicom Junior.
Oh, wow, that's very interesting.
And again, pretty much, feature-wise, same as the Super Nintendo revision. You know, at the time, I didn't think, oh, it's like a nerfed Super Nintendo, because, I mean, I wasn't thinking about things like, oh, you mean I should be saying composite, right?
Yes.
The fact, like, oh, that it only supports composite. video and stuff because I was just a kid. You know, I had this one. I loved it. It was an SNES, and it was at a cheap price point. I definitely got the Target exclusive Link to the Past bundle. I definitely remember that. There were different bundles. There was a Kirby Superstar one at Target, a Tetris Attack one at Toys R Us. And then also, there was one with Yoshi's Island that there's no information about where it was released, but it was definitely one of them.
Oh, that's really fascinating.
Now, those ones are kind of like, you know, just, they made sense. They were more streamlined, cheaper to produce, and, you know, offered a lower price point. But then, now we need to get into the Sega Genesis, the Sega Mega Drive, because I had the Genesis 2, which is, you know, the one that I remember and that most people kind of associate with the Genesis, because I think it was kind of the one that was out there the longest. But maybe not. Maybe that's just my age compared to your age.
Let the record show that I just made a scrunched-up looking face at Slagkick, because to me, the definitive Genesis is the Gen 1 Genesis. Sort of that weird, like, oblong, rectangle-y, like, weird dome off to the left of it.
Well, it's definitely more vintage-looking, you know?
Has that weird volume slider on it for the
headphone
jack.
I think it looks cool because I like, you know, boxy, bulky, retro-looking hardware. And, like, you know, it's kind of like how people, like, get into, like, really retro, boxy Honda Civics and stuff. But I mean, I definitely remember the Genesis 2, which, you know, got rid of the volume slider.
A headphone jack entirely, as I recall.
Yeah. But the thing that was more notable to me about the revisions is that because of, like, just all the differences between the two, they had to make two Sega CDs.
Well, you know, there's something more interesting to me about it than that, and that is because of all the changes they made to the hardware, there actually were software releases that wouldn't work on all versions of Genesis. One of the most popular at the time, having been EA's port of Populous, would run on the original Gen 1 Genesis that would not work on later Genesises.
Yeah, and you know,
which of course, I mean, it fits into that same line of how, you know, they both model of these two models of Genesis would not work with the Sega CD add-on.
Right, they had to seriously put out two different Sega CDs. One which was like a basically like, you know, a VCR DVD player looking thing that went under the Genesis one, and the then there was also the
one with the flip top.
The flip top, which sat side by side, which more like a portable CD player, a Walkman.
Yeah, although it is worth mentioning that although it sat side by side, it did have a little cradle for the Gen 2 Genesis.
Yep. And, you know, that's kind of an interesting thought was, you know, the fact that peripherals having to be different between the two, because there was the the Master System add-on thing that you could put in your Genesis, the power base converter, I'm sorry, that's what it was called, and it wasn't compatible, as far as I know, with the Genesis 2, or, they had to make another one for the Mega Drive, and I don't even know if that was available for Genesis. I think it was maybe just a Mega Drive one. But, you know, so the different Genesis revisions are kind of silly to think about. There was also a Genesis 3, which was even, like, more compact, because, you know, compact seems to be the kind of trend for these things.
Well, you know, as tech advances and you can get things on smaller dies or whatever, like, you start to downscale and make more efficient processes to produce this stuff. So that tracks. I mean, that's a normal part of electronics culture on the consumer level.
The interesting thing about the Genesis 3 is that Majesco manufactured it.
That is interesting, and I think we're going to come back to...
It was incompatible... sorry, go ahead.
Continue, finish.
And I think I follow where you're going, but it was still, I think, officially a Sega release as compared to a...
Yeah, I know that, but continue.
That it was incompatible with all of the add-ons like the Sega CD, 32X, the Power Base Converter, and you also couldn't play Virtua Racing, Gargoyles, and a couple other themes.
Oh, girl, no Gargoyles, no go.
Yeah, it couldn't support the game Genie. That's a pretty big deal.
Is it, though?
And yeah, I know where you're going, and we will revisit the further iterations of the Genesis.
Well,
but I want to take a minute to talk
about... For the sake
about...
of what we're discussing, the Sega Genesis Model 3 is the start of a really interesting branch off into sort of some weird games history that we're going to want to talk about a little later.
Yeah, but I want to talk about just the oversaturation of Mega Drive versions out there because...
Well, we haven't even talked about the Sega Nomad yet.
That's what I wanted to talk about.
Sega Nomad. Well, then get at.
The Sega Nomad has an interesting story that a lot of people might not realize. It was based on the Mega Jet, which was Japan Airlines' semi-portable Mega Drive for in-flight entertainment. And the Sega Nomad was the consumer version to this. And... it was notable because you could play your Genesis games on the go. But the problem was it had really, really, really bad battery life. It didn't have perfect compatibility, but it had, about 100%, I mean, not 100%, had about 600 titles that it did support. I believe that you could connect it with an AV output to use it as a Genesis, right?
Yeah, that's my understanding.
So, I mean, in theory, it should have been, like, a really cool thing, but the battery life was total crap. So
My entire Nomad experience can be summed up with some guy... I should not really tell this story on the air.
Because you were like, ooh, teenage gay romance.
Basically, yeah, I mean, but I knew a guy in high school that had one. It didn't go well. But yeah, I got to play it once. That was cool.
Did the batteries die, like, really, really fast on you?
They legit did. We were playing Shining Force 2 during stuff, and it didn't go super well, and things.
And then it affected the things and stuff and things.
We're not talking about that anymore. Move on.
So then you get a bunch of weird things that we'll kind of revisit with some other consoles later, where you get things with, like, the Pioneer Laser Active with the Mega Drive module, which was a laser disc player with Mega Drive, Mega CD games, and some specially created Mega LD games, Mega Laser Disc. And something that's kind of cool about this is that there was a module released by NEC that let you play TurboGrafx-16 games. So, like, actually the Laser Active sounds like it's kind of cool. And I remember that pretty well. There was also the CDX, or the Multimega, which was marketed as a portable CD player, kind of, and that also lets you play Genesis games if you hooked it up to a TV. So that was kind of interesting. But, I mean, you think about that, that's like a lot of different versions of the Genesis on the market kind of coexisting at the same time, which is kind of problematic for consumers. And, you know, I think that even today, when we talk about, you know, different console revisions or things like the DS, 3DS, Wii, Wii U, which are different systems, the naming schemes and everything can be confusing for consumers who aren't as educated. So, you know, I think that this is interesting to look at how many different genocide were out there. And,
I'm kind of legit cackling at you calling it that, though.
Genocide?
Yep. It sounds like genocide.
Oh, dear.
Well, it does sound like it's responsible for a lot of deaths.
Oh. Anyway, so that's kind of the funny history of the Mega Drive, but I do want to talk really briefly...
Did we not talk about the Firebox / Genesis 4 that we saw in Toys R Us the other day?
I thought you wanted to talk about those later, but do you want to talk about them now?
Maybe just this one.
One thing I wanted to talk about really quickly was, the Sega Neptune, which I remember reading about it in EGM and all those other magazines. It was supposed to be a Genesis with a 32X built in, and it got canceled. You know, later on, EGM did an April Fool's joke. I think it was that one of the ones we did on our...
I believe so. You know, April was a long time ago, so I don't really remember, but I think so.
Yeah, where they said, oh, you know, they found a warehouse of Sega Neptunes. But I remember the Sega Neptune because I wanted one. I didn't have a 32X because at the time I didn't
have... Who did, aside myself?
You did.
Yeah, well, I mean, but for the most part, who did?
You did.
Yeah, we've already addressed that, aside that.
So, you want to talk about the Genesis 4?
Yeah, you know, it's awful. Well, you can buy these even still at Toys R Us. The problem is that they use system-on-a-chip emulation technology. That's not like an official term. It's more of like a blast processing term, where it's just a thing people call for a thing that is done. Basically, there's a chip inside this device that acts like it's a Genesis. It's cool because it's like one of those plug-and-play devices for your TV where you just plug in like a cord and it has its own little controller and everything.
Yeah.
And this specific one has a cartridge slot. Which is
cool.
Awesome, especially for people like me. I have, you know, 50 to 100 Genesis cartridges hanging out here. And I was like, oh, this will be great. I can totally use this and play all my carts. I won't have to dig out my Genesis or any of my Genesis clones. I just have this cute little guy doing it. The emulation is awful. Like, music in nothing. Like, none of the music sounds right. Like, you pop in Castlevania Bloodlines and it's like, nope.
I mean, is it to the point where, like, it's just not playing stuff and it saves you...
No!
It's like that it butchers the already questionable quality of the Genesis sound chip?
Yup.
Uh-oh.
It is not a good, cute thing. It's pretty awful.
And, you know, this should not be confused with the Tech Toy Brazil-only release, the Mega Drive 4, which has an SD card slot. And stuff like that, so...
But also uses emulation technology, so it might not be super, super accurate.
Yep, and that's a lot of things that you run into with these retro releases that plug right into your TV.
Yeah.
If you're a consumer who doesn't care, like, if you're, like, a soccer mom who's like, hey, I remember playing Sonic the Hedgehog, that sounds neat, I'm gonna get that for my kids instead of the Xbox number one. That they want for the holiday season.
Man, there are going to be some kids asking for Xbox Ones this holiday season. I didn't even think about that.
Spoiled brats. Uneducated consumers. Anyway, would you like to talk about the PC Engine?
Not really. You know, the PC Engine had, you know, it was released in the US as the TurboGrafx-16. It had a variety of releases. It had, you know, the Turbo Duo,
Super Graphics.
Yeah, I mean, it had a lot of revisions, and unfortunately, I can't really, just off the top of my head, I can't really think of them all.
TurboGrafx and PC Engine was another kind of Famicom NES sort of thing. Looked very different on the from the two releases. Different names, you know, really trying to market, 16-bit. But, you know, it honestly never really found the market share that...
Certainly not in the U.S. To some degree in Japan, but, you know, something that is worth mentioning, like the Nomad we had just been talking about for the Genesis, there was a portable PC Engine. In Japan, it was called the PC Engine GT. The GT was short for Game Tank. In the U.S., it was released as the Turbo Express. And it could play all of the TurboGrafx-16 Hue card games. Which, you know, was actually pretty cool. It had, like, a TV tuner option, as I recall, which, you know, the Sega Genesis. The Sega Game Gear had a TV tuner as well, so, you know, it wasn't that unique at the time. This was sort of a common thing that was added, but it's still very interesting.
Yeah, and the Turbo CD, or, you know, what was it called, the Turbo CD in... TurboGrafx CD in Japan, PC Engine CD-ROM, had some pretty well-celebrated games, like Snatcher, your beloved Snatcher, and Castlevania Rondo of Blood.
Yeah, Rondo of Blood is a real classic that has endured. It's gotten re-releases on other consoles, but it was... sort of a really weird, tricky, hard-to-find game for a lot of us connoisseurs for many years because it was only released on you know, the PC Engine CD. And even then, it required the, like, one of the expansion cards or something. So it wasn't even just as simple as buying the console and playing it. And there were just, I mean, unfortunately, I'm simply not as well versed on this specific leg of the industry as I'd like to be. In fact, maybe I need to, really put my head down and start getting into PC Engine collecting. Maybe that needs to be my goal for 2014.
One of the things that's interesting about PC Engine CD, TurboGrafx CD, is that it didn't have region protection, but there were different CD formats, so you had to kind of figure out what you were getting. There was the CD, Super CD, and the Arcade CD. And the TurboGrafx CD let you play all Japanese and North American CD games. And if you had the Super System card, you could play all Japanese and North American SCD, Super CD, and CD games. And you had to get an Arcade System card to play Arcade CD titles.
Yeah. And, you know, this, again, sort of ties into, you know, the PC Engine family of, you know, like the Shuttle, the LT, the Core Graphics 1 and 2, the Duo R, the Duo RX. There were a lot of really weird variations that would try to have, you know, some of these, configurations sort of inbuilt so that you didn't have to deal with these expansion cards, the arcade card and super card or what have you. Really, it was just a big mess. Like, it's easy to look right now at what Nintendo's doing with the DS, DS Lite, DSi, DSi XL, 3DS, 2DS, 3DS XL, but like, they have still not nearly stepped into a pile of shit quite like what NEC did for themselves with the PC Engine TurboGrafx era.
That said, the Turbo Duo is probably, I don't know how available they are, but Turbo Duo probably makes the most sense, because all you need is a third-party converter to play WHO cards. I'm not really familiar with what WHO cards are, but they are... If you have a WHO card and a Japanese arcade card duo, you can play the Japanese arcade CD-ROM games.
Yeah, I mean, I actually have all of this.
Oh.
I just have never gotten into actually buying games for it.
Oh, wow. Well, you're all set.
I mean, I have some classic games that I bought contemporaneously to its release, but I haven't gotten into collecting in that regard.
So, again, kind of that probably contributed to the TurboGrafx PC Engine kind of not really taking off and NEC kind of getting out of that business.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. Especially in the U.S., I don't think people want to have to go to the market with an Excel spreadsheet. I'm sorry, WordPerfect at the time. Corel Word, you know. Anyway, you know, and sort of, I sort of look at that era of this as sort of the start of a trend. And, you know, you look at the sort of next generation lineup, and obviously, Sidekick, you have my notes here that you can look at for this.
Yep.
But sort of this next group of consoles, to me, it's clearly like, oh, pretty much everything had multiple versions and revisions at this point. You look at the Game Boy Advance is the easy place to start, because it had, you know, the Game Boy Advance Original, it had the Game Boy Advance SP, and then there was also the Game Boy Advance Micro.
Game Boy Micro. Yeah, and you know, one thing that I wasn't like turned off by it, but I was always like, oh, the GBA is like a hold it sideways one, you know, like not hold it sideways, but you know, it's to me it made me
horizontally
think more of
oriented rather
yes,
than
yes,
vertically.
Yes, it made me think more of a Game Gear, and that was very weird for me to get used to. So you know, I remember the original GBA. You really needed one of those little worm light thingies, you know, that you plugged into the cable slot in order to really get any decent lighting on it, because the screen was super dark. And so that's
I respectfully disagree, even though clearly enough people agreed with you at the time that there were like penny arcade strips about it and stuff.
I mean, it wasn't a hassle. It was just kind of a fact of life for me. But I mean, that's why the GBA SP was my preferred GBA, because it just was familiar with the vertical orientation, and it also had like the much better backlight. And I have the beautiful NES Classic version. as does Captain Spike.
What up, what up? Holding it in my hand right now.
And, I mean, I can't imagine. I thought I had lost it in the moving process, and I legit almost cried. But I had found it, so hurrah!
Yeah, you're like almost, but like I would have legit cried.
So let's talk really quick about the. Do you have anything else to say about the GBA?
You know, I don't think so. I really liked the Game Boy Micro a lot.
The Micro could not play any old school Game Boy stuff, of course.
Yeah, but it had really cool changeable faceplates. In Japan, in particular, there were a few limited editions that had just really breathtaking faceplates, including one for the GBA Final Fantasy IV re-release that had artwork by Yoshitaka Amano.
Delightful.
Yeah, so that was really, really cool. But it's mostly, it has a smaller screen than the original Game Boy Advance or the SP, which is interesting. You know, you usually don't see screens getting smaller on these revisions. But as a result, the picture image looks just really clear, like really sharp graphics. I really quite like it.
Right, yeah.
Makes playing some of these RPGs a little difficult to have the text in them scaled down, and they're already so tiny, but to me it's a worthwhile trade-off.
Yeah, so why don't we talk about the PlayStation and the PS1 specifically, because the PS1, again, is one that I had, and it was a cute little guy. It's, like, seriously sitting on top of a normal PlayStation, like, basically, like, two-thirds smaller.
Y'all can't see this at home, but I have my old PS1 and little guy PS1 out for comparison for Slidekick to be comparing right
now. Well, I mean, really, the name PS1 really came from that little guy. Once the PS2 had been announced, they rebranded the PlayStation as the PS1. So before that, no one was calling it the PS1 because it was just the PlayStation, you know? And
yeah.
So the thing that was really cool about that is that there was a little LCD screen you could get. You know, again, really just more compact. Unfortunately, there was protection against mod chips. You know, but still, totally functional.
You know, the funny thing is, I remember the protection against mod chips being much ballyhooed at the time, but in actuality, this PS1 that I have right here is actually modded, and it's the first console I ever owned that was modded. And I got it when it was like a brand new device, so whatever mod chip technology they had implemented must have been cracked, like, immediately.
And, you know, one thing that's interesting to note is that some of the earliest first batch of PlayStations had some laser issues. Some early models had problems with playing FMV or music. So, you know, that's one thing that sometimes these revisions do, you know, actually improve. You know, not just being compact, cheaper, and priced to sell later in the lifespan.
Oh, interesting.
The PS1 did not have a reset button. You just had to press the button, the power button.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was something that was a little strange.
But it was a really cute little system. It served me very well.
Yeah, me too. I bought one because I had a Japanese original PlayStation and an American original PlayStation, and my Japanese original PlayStation died, and my American one was on its last legs, and that's why I got this modded PS1 little guy, because he could just play both of them without any worries.
And again, it's interesting to see, you know, even though the original PlayStation was $94.95, still very boxy, and then again with the revision, kind of streamlining it, making it more compact, rounded, so it's interesting to see that trend with the scaling down of the size and kind of making it more rounded and form factor, etc. Before we talk about the PS2 revision that you're all probably thinking of, I want to talk about the PSX, the PlayStation X, which was not to be confused with the abbreviation for PlayStation 1, which used to be called the PSX.
That's why I never refer to the PS1 as the PSX, because the PSX is an actual thing, you Philistines.
Yeah, I don't know where people got the PSX from.
It was officially used for some time as like the PlayStation Experience or something, but I'm not really here for that.
And the PSX was notable for a couple different things. It was, in many ways, more so than being a PS2, it was a Sony DVR with a PS2 fully integrated. It was you know, more of a overall Sony device, not just a Sony Computer Entertainment device. It was the first Sony device with a cross-media bar, came with software for audio, video, and image editing. Just so it actually was really, it was a really solid piece of hardware. And I always was kind of jealous that we never got it out here in the United States. So, I think it was really kind of important by, you know, introducing that cross-media bar, whether you're a fan or not, that had influence on the, the later releases. So, could be linked to your PSP. I think it's a really cool thing. It has full support for PlayStation and PlayStation 2 software. And it has the Emotion Engine and everything. So, I mean, it's really online compatibility. Supports a hard disk drive like Final Fantasy XI. So, I mean, really kind of, in Japan, I would say the definitive PlayStation 2.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at PlayStation's twos in this room, both that have hard drives and modems installed. So, I mean, it doesn't sound like anything super incredible in terms of, like, you can't get these features anywhere else, but it is really neat to have them all consolidated into the box.
With a DVR and everything.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's neat. It's
for the time, I think, you know, it's kind of a big deal. Of course, the PS2 revision that we all think of is the slim PS3. Really,
two.
PS2, yes, you're
generally
right.
Referred to as the PS2 Slimline.
Yep. And, again, definitely more streamlined, tiny little guy. I always wanted to pick one up, even though my PS2 still works. I always just wanted to pick one up just to have one, because they were cute little guys.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, there are actually a few hardware configurations within the Slimline line. Originally, they were being made with separate Emotion Engine and, the other core processor. But later on, once these chips were consolidated, the Emotion Engine and the graphics synthesizer, they were later on put onto basically like one chip that had both of these pieces integrated.
Ah.
Which was also, I mean, this change also happened in other places where these chips were being used. It's not just the Slimline PS2s. And as far as I'm aware, they'd still run most software correct.
Another interesting note in the PS2 hardware revision, not really hardware revision, but there were, for a while, some Bravia, Sony Bravia HDTVs that had a PS2 built in.
I'm mad that you said that, because it's a part of my sidebar from later that we were going to talk about. That tagline that says, Sony TVs with PlayStation shit built in. So, boo on you.
Oops.
Why don't you talk about that model number right now and just get it out of the way?
It is the Sony Bravia KDL22PX300 TV. It was a 22-inch Bravia HDTV.
That's cool. I should try to find one. That seems like a cute little curio.
Yeah, they don't make them anymore, Obvo.
Well, yeah, that was years ago. But it would be nice to have one, and maybe I can find one secondhand.
Yeah, so now let's talk about the PSP.
Can we not?
No, we both like our PSPs, so...
Yeah, well, it's my birth by sleep device. I need one to live.
Of course, the first PSP, kind of a chunky guy. The PSP 2000 was the slim and light, but still called a PSP in North America, Japan, China, India, Italy, and Portugal. So PAL regions, for some reason, called it the slim and light.
Because they needed a different differentiator, and for whatever reason, Sony and the rest of the world did not opt to differentiate at all. Of course, those of you who were in the market for PSPs at the time, you might remember going to stores and having to look and, like, sort of evaluate the box of, like, which device is this? Because this might not have the screen I want. Something that came up multiple times in these two releases, as well as the PSP 3000, or, however we're going to refer to it. The nomenclature changed a little bit. But it is that the screens were not the same across all units, and some of them would look better for certain games.
Right. The PSP 2000 One thing that was notable is they doubled the internal memory to compensate for the original PSP's poor load time for UMD games. But one thing I remember talking to
It made no meaningful difference.
I remember talking to Salacious Pop around the time that these revisions were coming out. Salacious Pop, of course, being Alan, my former co-host from Fabulous Flames, and the boyfriend of Rob Roberts for Orange Lounge Radio. The PSP 3000, which was also still called the Slim and Light in the PAL regions, also known as the PSP Bright, had a brighter screen.
And 2D games looked awful on it.
So anything that was sprite-based had, like, ghosting issues.
Yes, it was really, really very poor.
One interesting thing is about the slimmer PSPs have a reduced battery capacity, but because it's more power efficient, it's still the same runtime. Something else that was a little interesting note is that the PAL regions got a PSP E1000 in 2011, so not that long ago. It has no Wi-Fi. Mono speaker, no microphone, so.
Yeah, it's basically a PSP version of that awful Wii Mini that we're gonna talk about.
Ooh, I can't wait for that. So, yeah, if you're still in the market for a PSP, just do your research because, the PSP 2000 is the best one for if you're into, like, sprite-based games.
Yeah, you're absolutely incorrect though. The actual answer if you're in the market for a PSP is to get a PSP Go.
Oh, good point, because that is something that we didn't even talk about yet.
Yeah.
The PSP Slim and Light had a beautiful Crisis Core edition, though.
Yeah, some of the special edition consoles that Sony has ever... Well, I say Sony, that Square has ever done with any other company. So, you know, any of, like, the Kingdom Hearts DS family devices, the Game Boy Micro that we talked about... certainly the PSPs that they did, both for Birth by Sleep and for Crisis Core, they're all just so, so pretty.
Why don't you talk about the PSP Go?
Yeah, so the PSP Go is a weird little beast. It is theoretically a digital distribution-only console. It does not have a UMD disk drive, which sucks, because it means that getting games... you have to buy them off PSN, and they have to be games that are supported on, PSN, that have PSN releases. This obviously means that you can't play something like Crisis Core on it, or Kingdom Hearts Birth by Sleep.
Which is problematic.
Which is problematic, unless, and I certainly don't condone piracy, I'm not telling you that you should pirate games. I am telling you that, despite Sony's insistence that the PSP Go is unhackable, there is an extremely simple-to-use hack out there for the PSP Go. And once you hack it and you can just load ISOs of games onto your device, it becomes what is, to me, by far the most desirable handheld console that has ever existed. It has 16 gigs of internal flash memory, that can be expanded up to 32 gigs.
Wow.
Which is the configuration that I use. I use my other PSPs to rip my UMDs so that I'm creating my own ISOs to put on my PSP Go, because I do not support software piracy. And playing this way, using this, again, this it's like the Game Boy Micro in that the PSP Go has a slightly smaller screen, and as a result, all of the games on it, when you're playing on it, the graphics just appear crisper and sharper by virtue of being scaled down a little bit.
Nice.
And it has a proper stick rather than the weird little PSP slidey nub that most people don't
that
like.
Oh, slidey nub, yeah, it's kind of tough.
Yeah, the Go has a real stick.
Oh.
And it just becomes by far
it's
the
a real
best.
Boy.
with a hack in place, and again, I'm not condoning pirating these games. But with a hack in place to play legitimately purchased games that aren't playable on the device otherwise, it becomes by far my preferred way to play any PSP content.
That's great.
Everything looks great. It controls great. That stick is awesome. It has great battery life. I cannot rant and rave enough about this configuration for play if you're serious about playing these games in the highest quality possible.
Excellent. DS, I don't feel like we actually need to spend too much time on because I think a lot of people remember the DS revisions, but I mean, we're still going to talk about them, obviously.
Well, you know, there was...
I always just kind of forget that the DS started out as a big chunky guy.
Well, yeah, I think that the image that comes to most people's mind when they think of the DS is the DS Lite, which, of course, was a lot smoother, a lot sleeker, a lot sexier.
It was sexy. I still have my white DS Lite.
You know, I didn't get a DS Lite for a long time. I loved my original weird-looking fat boy. But when I have...
Weird-looking fat boy?
That what? That
you talking about me?
I'm just like, what? That basically describes the kind of guy I'm into.
Anyway... DS Lite, you're right, that is kind of the more iconic DS that people think of, because then you move on to
Well, you look at the DS, and you look in terms of lifetime sales of the console, and people were buying the original DS. Make no mistake, it was not doing poorly. But where that platform really took off was when Nintendo did their promotions with, you know, all of these celebrities... like Penelope Cruz, I think, maybe did one, and all of these celebrities playing their DS Lites, Utada Hikaru in Japan playing Nintendogs, and just selling the DS Lite as, like, this really sleek, super sexy, like, gal-on-the-scene console.
You even had the not a hot pink, but more like a very smooth salmon pink.
Yeah, and this thing, it got to the point where monthly it was moving millions of units worldwide. And just
to the point of the sales of the DS Lite being so good that the 3DS's initial sluggish sales were, like, surprising.
Oh, well, I don't think they were surprising as much as I think that people really misread what those results meant, because their view was skewed by how enormously popular the DS and specifically the DS Lite sold.
Yeah. One thing that's interesting.
Everyone was buying this thing. A lot of my girlfriends that I work with, they would go out to, like, ladies, like, makeup nights, and Nintendo would be at these events doing DS Lite promos. Like, I'd have girls coming up to me like, what is a DS Lite? Why do I want one? Because I totally do. I still have all of these really cute, like, little mirror compacts that have, like, Nintendo logos emblazed on them.
Wow.
And I'm just like, I wish I was into drugs, because having all these pocket mirrors would be awesome.
Oh, dear.
I'm not, by the way.
One thing that's kind of a difference between Captain Spike and I is that I traded in my fat DS for a Lite. You kept your fat DS and didn't upgrade until, I mean, you didn't trade it in, but you got a DSi instead. So you want to talk a little bit about the DSi to us and your experience with it and why you
Well, I did get a DS Lite. I got one of the Pokemon DS Lites that came out when Pokemon Mystery Dungeon Explorers of maybe Light and Dark was that generation.
I don't remember.
And it's really cool. It has some super cool looking Pokemons on the outside of it. I kind of really, 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 really love it. But I did eventually buy a DSi, because the DSi had new software that was only, in theory, only going to be available on the DSi. It had its own eShop for digital distribution games. It had a camera on the outside, which, you know, it was basically a proto 3DS. A lot of the 3DS concepts that to a lot of people were very new actually got their start in the DSi. The DSi's form factor was like a slightly bigger, significantly heavier, version of the DS Lite. It's actually a really heavy little, weird, like, slug of a unit.
All right.
And it had larger screens than the DS as well, but not as large as the DS XL.
The DSi XL, you mean?
Yeah, well, yes, the DSi XL. I always forget that was a DSi in that XL.
Right, and that was kind of an interesting trend that started, now we're seeing it with the 3DS, is where instead of getting smaller and sleeker, you got a bigger form factor.
Yeah, that to me is something that's really interesting. It's sort of the opposite direction that you would expect, again, a handheld to take. But I guess it was really marketed more towards older folks, people who might want to play, you know, brain age, concentration training, or whatever.
And I love my 3DS XL, so.
Yeah, that 3DS XL, I don't have one. I use my original 3DS. I'm still very happy with it. I will almost certainly buy a 2DS. But the 3DS XL, like, I look at it, and it's gorgeous. It's just like this gigantic beast of a thing.
Yeah, really, you know, sexy form factor.
I've talked here on the show
We're
in the past.
We're kind of jumping ahead to the 3DS. But
I will absolutely buy a 3DS XL once one comes out that is a limited edition in a style that I like.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, getting back on track.
You want to tell us a little bit about the Neopoke and the WonderSwan?
Well, you know, these are both little handheld consoles, with differing degrees
Neo
of
Pocket,
North
being the Neo Geo Pocket.
Of course. Varying degrees of availability in North America. I would guess it's probably fair to wager that most people are not familiar with these platforms. So it's a little bit silly to focus on for too much, but you know, the Neo Geo Pocket had an original release, and then it had the release of the Neo Geo Pocket Color, which it was not such a big difference as the release between the Game Boy and the Game Boy Color, which, again, like you said earlier, you could argue that it's a new console. With the Neo Geo Pocket Color, it still played all the old games. Some of the new games could still be played on the old console, but it had color now, and this, as far as I'm aware, was the only retail configuration it was available for in the U.S., although I do think it had multiple colored units available. Like, you could get one with, like, a camo color, or one with, like, a slate graphite color, which is the one that I have. And then, you know, the WonderSwan, which is a little bit strange, because, you know, you get into WonderSwan and ColorSwan and CrystalSwan.
Yep, the Swan Crystal really being notable because it had a better LCD. It had a TFT LCD screen. So, kind of, probably the definitive WonderSwan, I would guess.
I can see that you're looking at Wikipedia through the mirror that's behind you.
Well,
you cheating ass bish.
But, you know, like, again, like you were saying, sharper contrast for handhelds is desirable. So, I think that sounds like the Swan Crystal would be the most definitive release.
Yeah. Yeah, no, certainly. And, you know, there was also, you know, Final Fantasy bundles for the WonderSwans that had Final Fantasy games, because,
yep,
you know, the game, some of the earlier remakes that we got of Final Fantasy games on Game Boy Advance started their life as Japanese WonderSwan game releases. So, that's just a little notable. And, you know, to me, that sort of ends a whole nother era of this discussion, and we sort of come to the here and now. Sort of looking at the Wii, the PS3, the Xbox 360, and the 3DS. Psychic, why don't you tell us and our audience at home about the three major iterations of the Wii?
Well, I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about the original Wii because, I mean, it's
well,
the
yeah,
Wii.
It's the Wii.
The first one that was notable was the Wii Family Edition. I think over here in the States it was like a Walmart exclusive, maybe. And it was notable because it removed the GameCube functionality.
There may have been a bundle that was exclusive to a retailer, but I don't think that device in its entirety was, because I've definitely seen them at, like, Fry's Electronics, for example.
Oh, okay. So, but that would be the most notable difference, is that the GameCube compatibility was taken out.
Okay, but what I really want to talk about
is the Wii Mini. It took out a lot of stuff. You can't. It has no Wi-Fi support, so no online gaming. No component or S-video output.
Yeah, you're pretty much stuck with, like, composite.
Yeah, composite. So really nerfed down.
It's basically
compatibility issues.
Well, it's basically like a hack-free Wii. The way I look at the Wii Mini is basically I look at, like, okay, Nintendo tried to make as, like, direct a Wii game only box as possible. They took out all of the weird cool extra stuff that the Wii could do, all of the internet stuff, all of the eShop stuff. There's no weather channel and no Mario Kart channel to compare race times. Like, no, this is just put a Wii disc in and play your Wii disc.
Yeah.
And, you know, certainly I suspect, well, you know, I suspect there might be a market for that, because otherwise why would they have made it? But I really question to whom they were trying to sell this. I cannot help but think that anyone who's in the market for a Wii would have wanted a Wii that could do all of that cool stuff, all of the online games, get some of these really incredible eShop, or I'm sorry, whatever the Wii eShop was called. Get some of these really cool digital games, and, cause again, the Wii had so many really great digital distribution games that, these people will never see. Stuff like, Final Fantasy IV The After, stuff like Final Fantasy Crystal Chronicles, My Life as a Little King, and My Life as a Dark Lord. So, the Wii Mini is just like, I am a super tiny Wii, I am scarcely bigger than the size of the disc that will fit inside me, and I am only going to play your Wii games. No weather for you.
Yeah.
PS3 is one that you in particular talk about a lot, Slidekick. I think that probably 99% of the time that the PS3 comes up, you make a joke about the number of SKUs the PS3 has
had. Yeah, well, I mean, I think the most notable thing, before there was even a redesign, was the removal of the emotion engine and everything, and so there were models of the fat PS3 that couldn't even play, emulated games. I QQ'd a lot about that on the first year of Game Buoy, and, you know, I had my issues with Sony, but when we think of really the revisions, there it was the Slim and the Super Slim, and, you know, I don't really have much to say about the Slim because I don't own one. It seemed cool, but I really like my Super Slim. You know, it has kind of like this slidey open disc tray thing. And, you know, I mean, I'm really happy with it. You know, it's a nice compact form factor. I mean, I thought all the PS3s looked pretty nice, pretty sexy. But, you know, again, continuing that trend of kind of a sleeker form factor. Obviously, the backwards compatibility... It's kind of just, we just got used to it not being a feature. And, it kind of really just focused on, the PS3 experience, blah, blah, blah. And, that's pretty much all I have to say about that, which is surprising because I had a lot to say about it before. And, you know, the thing about the different SKUs is that, true, there were, like, probably, like, 27 different SKUs, but... You know, it's a different SKU for each hard drive size, but unfortunately, especially with the early on, the fat PS3s, with there still being possible access to getting a original one with the hardware-based emulation, because that was the thing, there was a hardware-based emulation, software-based PS2 emulation, and then just like, nope, no PS2 emulation. So, and I understand, thinking about it now, they... had to really cut down production costs because they were losing money. I mean, you know, the PS3 really was not doing well for a long time. And, but I think the PS3 really ended up in a good spot. They kind of had to streamline it a little bit, but, I'm happy with mine. So, do you have anything to add?
Not really. I haven't really put a lot of time into any PS3 units other than the, early ones, like the one that I have here.
Yep.
This was actually, and this sucks, but I have the first one that didn't have PlayStation 2 backwards compatibility.
Oh.
Yeah,
my first PS3 was one with the hardware-based.
Yeah, I remember, because I remember trying to convince you not to sell it, and you were like, nope, sold it. So,
yeah, so that's kind of regretful, but I still have a PS2, so,
Yeah.
Although I don't have a way to upscale the PS2 games, so that's unfortunate, but,
yeah. But I don't actually have a lot to say about the myriad configurations of the PlayStation 3. The one I have serves me well. I do wish it had backwards compatibility. I hear people talk about how for them backwards compatibility isn't a huge selling point, and I just sort of facepalm because... I have games that are like 30 years old that I still like to play, and it really sucks that there's this sort of, to me, artificial barrier between my PlayStation 2 games and I, because I can't play them in my PS3 because of when I bought my PS3. So cool.
Something consumer expectations that backwards compatibility is just going to be included, which we're kind of seeing things to get away from, actually, a little bit.
Yeah, we really are. We've talked about this on this show at length
PS4,
before,
X-Bone, blah, blah, blah,
about
blah,
the PS4 and the bone. We'll see where things go moving forward.
The 360, of course, there's the original 360, and the first redesign was in 2010, officially called the 360S, but, just still marketed as
the 360. And something I want to point out here is that although not in terms of retail configurations... Again, people in the know were tracking what Xboxes they were buying of the original fat old Xboxes, because certain model numbers had different internal hardware. There were different chipsets, and some of them were more prone to red rings of death than others. So, while not strictly actually being, you know, retail revisioning and reversioning and sort of what we're really talking about here, as just a little sidebar, I remember people looking for, oh, Jasper this, Falcon that, chipsets, and all of this nonsense.
Yeah. One thing that was kind of pissed off original early adopters, you know, before the 360S was that there was built-in Wi-Fi, so you didn't have to buy that, like, $70 adapter that we all did when we bought our 360s earlier on.
I have an old 360, and I still just use a wired connection, so I don't even know.
Oh, that makes sense. You also didn't have memory card slots because they added the USB flash drive support with the release, like with a software update that came around this release. You know, just otherwise, the other real notable thing is that you could put a laptop hard drive in instead of using, like, you know, their own. But there were ways to put an old 360 hard drive, just like putting it in the drive bay. There were ways to make it work. So that was the first real revision. And then earlier this year, you know, just a couple months ago, we had the new 360, which is, again, just another redesign, kind of meant to look a little bit more like the Xbox One. And I don't really know too much about what the differences are, other than the form factor looks a little bit different. Do you have anything to really say about the brand new 360?
You know, I don't. We talked about it on the show a little bit previously, but I have not actually seen one in the wild yet. I'm actually want to go out and do some retro game shopping as soon as we wrap up here today, and I'm really hoping that at least one of the shops we hit will have one of those, so I can at least see it and really start to get a feel for what it has to offer.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know if there's anything notable aside from the fact that it's meant to look pretty on your shelf next to your X-Bone. So, with that, we already kind of touched on the 3DS. You know, the first 3DS came out, and we both were day one adopters.
Oh, of course.
I ended up not trading mine in, like, which was a trend that I used to do, is trade in for the newer revisions, but I kept it for quite a long time once I got my 3DS XL. I ended up selling it to Dark Sakura from OLR so that she would be able to enjoy Animal Crossing.
That's awesome, keeping it in the family. I'm actually a big fan of selling games to friends. You know, and I say selling, I tend to just give, but
right.
I really prefer, like, all of these games that I love and treat like children because I'm one of those creepy people. Like, I really prefer, like, keeping it in the family, and, like, I'd rather see this go to a good home with someone who's going to play it and appreciate it. Then, like, I'm going to GameStop. This is going to get owned by someone that doesn't like it and stores crack rocks in its battery compartment.
Well, it's not with crack rocks, but, I mean, the story I'm about to tell has nothing to do with crack rocks. But, you know, I just was thinking, like, this kind of reminds me of when I think it's when I wanted to get my Super Nintendo. And I was, like, you know, maybe, like, 12 at the time.
Okay.
So, you know, obviously still living at home because I was a kid.
You were 12, yeah.
Yeah. My mom was like, there are too many video game systems in the entertainment center. You're going to need to trade some of these in to the local game store, which was just like this, you know, used game store local to me. You know, instead of,
speak into your mic a little more.
Oh, you know, we could just store it in a box. And then if you want to play that one in the future, we can get it out. So I had to trade in my Genesis and Sega CD, and because you have to remove part of the Genesis to hook it into the Sega CD or something.
Like a slidey bit guy, yeah.
Because of that, they only gave me $8.
And I
kind of forever have held a grudge.
Good. Yeah, I would too. That sounds awful.
And so that doesn't have anything to do with hardware revisions necessarily. But
yeah, but you're the one who was telling me I need to cool down and let people appreciate our unique opinions or something. So go with that. Like, practice what you preach.
Anyway, And now to the 2DS. So we haven't really said much aside from the fact that you plan on getting a 2DS. Why is that?
Well, I mean, at $129, it's basically an electronics impulse buy.
Yeah, one thing that a lot of criticism that's out there is that, oh, it'll be scratched really easily because it doesn't have a clamshell design. I kind of see it more as something that I would play, like, if I was just laying in bed or sitting out on the couch here at SS Game Buoy or something.
Now let us make no mistake here. That's not what this is designed for. I mean, I appreciate that that's a use it has in your life, and that is almost certainly a use it will have in my life. Like, this is not going to live in my briefcase with my normal 3DS and stuff, like, and my Vita and all that. This is something that will live on my coffee table for when I'm sitting at home with my feet kicked up and just want to play a little Pokemon or something. But, again, while that's how I'll utilize it in my life, to me, this seems like a clear-cut business plan to get, especially in advance of the holiday, to get a relatively cheap 3DS option out there on the market at the same time as Pokemon.
So and kind of playing into the bullshit claims that, oh, 3D can damage kids' eyesight.
Oh, I do think that there's probably something to that, or to it being in the face of that. Certainly, you know, this is a claim that there are even warnings on because we live in Sioux, where there are warnings on game boxes because we live in Sioux crazy, USA. But, in terms of actual studies that have been done, there hasn't been, incidents of, like, 3D causing any sort of degenerative issues in the eyes of children, despite that being a frequently repeated meme. And, you know, certainly you have to wonder, I remember when the 3DS came out, I did see some sensationalist headlines about the new Nintendo device that will kill your children's eyes.
I mean, the thing that's interesting is that if they had made a 2DS and a 3DS at launch, like, I probably would have gone for the 2DS, because I can't really do the 3DS 3D. I don't know, it's just something with my eyes and, like, eye strain and stuff. I can't really do it.
Yeah, a lot of people play without 3D on. I play without 3D on while I'm commuting because I want to make my battery life last, and turning the 3D on effectively cuts it in half, which, as a commuter, I simply cannot make that sacrifice.
So it's just kind of interesting that they chose, like, a slate form factor.
Well, the reason for the slate form factor is because that's actually one screen under that plastic.
Right.
You know, they haven't really talked too much about it, but estimations as far as what it would cost for these devices, indicate that this device probably costs about a third to make compared to the other 3DSs. So even selling at $130, which is, you know, substantially smaller than what the other devices sell for, Nintendo's gonna be making a pretty penny off of each unit sold. So, I mean, to me, this is like a triple threat. It's like the best possible gameplay that you could make for the 3DS in light of Pokemon coming out. Because they're going to have a device that's cheaper to sell, that has a higher profit margin, that is going to be definitely marketed as, you know, safer for kids, as like a safe alternative for them to be playing Pokemon on as a new generation of 3D Pokemon games are hitting.
Yep.
To me, that is just Sonic Triple Trouble.
It is
just, to me, an absolutely brilliant business move. And, you know, I've seen a lot of QQ on the internet about people not wanting to buy this or not liking the form factor or, you know, this, that, and the other. And keeping in mind that I'm completely not even really looking at the fact that for a lot of people, this device might be the only 3DS they can easily afford.
Yeah.
You know, I'm very blessed in this world. I'm very fortunate to have, you know, a job that I like, that affords my habits and my hobbies. But there's also, you know, there are a lot of lower income people that probably want a 3DS and can't have one. And the 2DS is going to put that, you know, that goal a little bit closer to their hands. So I think it's a slam dunk. If it was foldy, if it wasn't for that whole single screen that is just separated by physical plastic shell, as the case is here, I would probably be interested in buying a 2DS to replace my 3DS.
Same here.
But it's not, and so I don't, and that's fine. But I'll still probably buy one as an impulse, and that's, you know, that's interesting in and of itself. I think it'll look cute sitting on my table next to my Wii U gamepad.
Yep.
And, you know, I think we've said all there is to say about the 2DS. Do you have anything else to add?
Nope. Let's talk about some silly sidebars.
Yeah, so we have three real specific hardware configurations that we haven't covered here. We're going to talk about them, and we're going to try to wrap this show up pretty quick. So I want to talk first about the Panasonic Q. This was, of course, a really just absolutely beautiful-looking console that was made by Panasonic, as you probably guessed by the name, that was a GameCube player that also functioned as, like, a media center insofar as having, like, a DVD player built in and, like, a radio tuner and connections to act as almost like a receiver for other audio devices or what have you. It was beautiful. It was chrome-plated in the same basic form factor of a GameCube. So it's still like that square sort of design, except it looked like a metal block, a really shiny metal block.
I remember that it needed a different Game Boy player because a Game Boy Advance player because
yeah, I think legs. Even though it was Game Boy Advance games, it was still called Game Boy Player.
Oh, huh.
But yeah, no, you're absolutely right on that fact. My story about the Panasonic Q is that I had the opportunity to buy one for like $300 when it was new, and I passed on it because I didn't have the money at the time. I mean, I did, but I shouldn't have spent it, so I didn't. And I went back to that game shop that had it like 2 weeks later, and they had already sold it. I was so mad. It was, of course, an import, and I had an import GameCube already, but I wanted this freaking shiny, cute box so bad. I was so miserable. I still look for them on eBay, but unfortunately they've gotten pretty expensive.
Dope.
Yeah, yeah. You know, also up here we have the Wonder Mega. This was an all-in-one Sega CD Genesis solution made by JVC. You might be familiar with this in North America as the XI. This was sold as like a complete family package, to play karaoke discs on. It came with like, an electronic cyclopedia on disc, in Carta or something. And it was, sold here again, similar to the way that Nintendo sold the NES as, you know, not really a games, device, but games were sort of secondary in its purpose. Slackick, do you have anything to say about the Wonder Mega?
Nope. But I do have something to say about LOL Brazilian Sega devices.
Go for it.
One thing that if you're a Sega fan, you're probably very familiar with the huge, huge following that not only Mega Drive, but Master System has in Brazil. I mean, down to the fact of the Brazilian Sega metal band, Mega Driver. And there are still Master System and Mega Drive variants being produced today, much like the Firecore that we see at Toys R Us and such. You know, it's still really popular in Brazil. And Tech Toy is actually kind of notable because they were always the producers and distributors for Sega consoles in Brazil. So,
keeping it in the family.
I'm looking at the Tech Toys website, and it looks like currently they have three different Sega devices. There is the Master System Evolution Blue, which has a really cool like Sonic kind of a decal on it. There is the Master System Portatil, which looks like just it's a controller, which presumably is built in to, you know, plug right into your TV. And the MD Play, which presumably is a portable Mega Drive. So, and they've been making variations of these for years. Like we said, Brazil loves Master System and Mega Drive, like, a lot. So, it's kind of a cute footnote for the Sega, that Sega's still living strong in Brazil, so. That's it.
Excellent. Well, unless you have anything else to say on the topic, I think we may be done discussing.
I think so. So why don't we move on to
I said, hey, what's going on?
So, Captain Spike, what you been playing?
I've been playing Final Fantasy XIV. I'm really into it.
Final Fantasy XIV? That's right, and you mentioned that you were working on a monk, trying to build up to a monk.
Yeah, I'm really excited to play more and get more time into it. You know, certainly some of the login issues are a little bit annoying, but...
Yeah.
But fortunately, as I said earlier, it hasn't really impacted me personally that much. I've still gotten in every day. Just, you know, after trying a bit. Again, I don't really like having to try for literally, like, 5 minutes to get into a game. But
yeah.
On the scale of things, like, it's...
Hashtag first world problem.
Exactly so.
Yeah.
What about you? What have you been playing?
Yeah, just about Final Fantasy XIV. I'm just kind of regrettably not able to invest the time in that. But I really hope that soon I'll be able to play... I've been playing Netflix, on PS3 and System Settings on 3DS. No, I'm totally kidding, even though I have been using those. Well, not System Settings. Mostly what I've been playing, and it's funny that you, were putting your, Tetris cartridge into your Game Boy Pocket earlier, because I have been playing the 3DS Virtual Console release of Tetris, because, you know, I'm trying to research for my, Tetris musical that I'm working on. But I've just really been in a Tetris mood, really into the Tetris music lately. And so, you know, I thought, I'm going to play some Tetris. One thing that I kind of discovered in the process of this was that the Tetris DSi game is no longer available because of licensing issues. That was Tetris Party Live, and that lets you do, like, online multiplayer. It was a $5 digital download from the DSi or 3DS eShop. And as of right before the launch of the SS Game Buoy, the end of March 2012, it actually has not been available. So I was a little disappointed about that. But, you know, still old-school Tetris, always a gem. Never gets old. Truly never gets old. So also kind of really has allowed me to still have fun, take a break from my busy schedule, and yeah.
Excellent.
And with that, I think it's time to move on to our social links. Our social links question of the week was, this week we talk hardware reiteration. Has there ever been a platform design that sold you on hardware that you didn't already want? And we got a few answers. So Crystal D, Game Boy Superfan, commented over on Facebook. She said, I had no interest in getting a GBA SP until they released the limited edition Nintendo design. Of course, it was also when they re-released the original Super Mario Brothers and Dr. Mario, so of course I had to have the matching system. That's right, that was like the Famicom Classics Collection?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. So.
Nintendo Classics.
Nintendo
but, yeah.
Classics over here, yeah. And of course, that's what Captain Spike and I both did. Gorgeous, gorgeous one.
You know, I didn't actually buy any of the U.S. releases of any of those Classics games.
Oh, I'm sorry, I meant the SP that we got. That was the one that Crystal D got.
Yeah. Yeah, but they did a line of games for, right, for those
right,
as
right.
well, the
Sorry,
classics.
That's what I meant, was that we both adopted that SP. We waited for the SP for that. Jeremy from Koopa Club commented on Facebook saying, also the GBA SP. He said, I had no interest in owning the system until I laid eyes on that bad boy, which is weird to me because that thing had so many amazing games on it. Yeah, GBA is kind of funny to think of it as the black sheep of the Game Boy / DS family of handhelds. And I mostly think of that because, like, Super Circuit is my least favorite, Mario Kart, for example. But GBA was really pretty great. So I agree.
You know, I have a funny story about the GBA that this actually made me think of. So Anime Expo happened the year that the GBA came out. Anime Expo happened in Los Angeles literally, like, a week after the GBA came out in Japan. It was still not set for release in the U.S. for another 2 or 3 months. I was there with Seawolf Jason, who has appeared here on Game Buoy with us as a guest. And we literally had a game plan for the first day of the Anime Expo convention to run to the dealer's room, to this one video game booth, import booth, that was there every year. And we both were just like, we are going to go there first thing and get Game Boy Advances at this booth. And they would be imports, obviously. And, like, no matter what the cost, we both agreed, as long as it was under, like, $300 each, we'd buy them. So we get there. First thing, I want to say that we were the literal first two people at this booth that day. And they had two Game Boy Advances.
And you got them?
And so the two of us, we each bought one, yes.
That's awesome.
That blue-purple Game Boy Advance there in that corner... That is a Japanese launch Game Boy Advance.
Wow,
yeah,
I always thought that was just your regular guy.
No, I never actually bought the domestic release of that because I had this really incredible Japanese one. It's completely region-free, and I loved it. That's why when you go into my game collection, I have all of those Japanese Game Boy Advance games, because that first month that it was available just in Japan, I was importing left and right, because I just wanted games.
Games, lots of games.
But then, again, you know, like Jeremy says, I didn't think I wanted to upgrade, I didn't want to change, up until I saw that NES SP.
Yeah.
And then it was on, like, Donkey Kong. I had to have that. In fact, Space Pirate Ben and I went to a local Game Crazy and bought both of ours on the same day because we were there when they came in. They had two that weren't pre-sold. And so he was just like, I'll take one. And I was like, I will take the other.
Oh, wow. That's magical.
Yeah. So that's just what I thought of when we got that letter. Thank you, Jeremy. Continue.
Jonathan Pancakes S. Can I call you Pancakes? Says, yeah.
Yes,
for me,
Mama.
Yes, for me. Yeah, for me, it was the GBA SP. The backlight was a game changer. Previously, you would have to play it under a light or well-lit room, or with a glowworm or light screen attached to the front. Yep. Sometimes with a magnifying glass.
Oh, wow. Apparently, it was not just you.
And forget playing outside. The glare of the sun is killer. The SP got me to buy the GBA. Also, at the time, kids were pretending it was a flip phone. Fun portable light. I don't remember kids pretending it was a flip phone. That's amazing.
Well, I wasn't a kid in that vintage, but I imagine that's a thing kids would have done, and that's awesome.
That is awesome. Thanks for your feedback, Pancakes, over on Facebook. And Francisco Yu said, for me, it was the 3DS XL. I wasn't a fan of the DS or the 3DS system, and I almost bought the DSi XL because it was bigger, but I passed. Then I held a 3DS XL and loved how big the screen was, how much better the 3D effect looked. I regret not owning a DS prior to November 2012 because, my God, there are so many games to catch up on, like freshly picked Tingle's Rosy Rupee Land. So, Francisco, you must be a bit of a size queen, eh? No, I kid. But, yeah, the DS has so many great titles. I'm so glad that you adopted, and I do love the 3DS XL. I just think it's, like we said, great, great console.
Oh, my gosh. Some girl on my Facebook just bought a Gen 1 Genesis and posted an image of it on her Facebook. Like, literally.
That is so cool.
Like, literally, like, 4 minutes ago. And I'm like, while I'm recording this episode, this is incredible.
That's amazing. Is it someone I know?
It's not. It's this girl that I went to school with and then worked with a few years later.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah,
that's
about awesome. To drop her a line right now.
Yeah, let's give her a link to this episode on GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
Space Pirate Ben over on Twitter said that he wanted a Sega Nomad even though he never owned a Genesis. I think we all wanted Sega Nomads except for you who had a teen summer romance. And it didn't go well. Keitaro E37 on Twitter said, the DS Lite made me take the DS seriously. Instead of a system, I only had interest to play Mario Kart. Interesting. So yeah, that DS Lite, very sexy. We got a little bit of general feedback. Kiki Tosario, a.k.a. Ricardo from Still Alive Studios, said, just heard the podcast. Thanks for the mention, guys. We got greenlit this week. Yay!
Yay! You know, this is something I was going to talk about earlier in the show here. I had this set to discuss during news, but actually once I saw your tweet, and I actually only saw this morning, but once I saw it, it was very clear to me that I really wanted to cover this just here within your feedback. Thank you so much. It was our pleasure to look at this early version of this game. We're huge fans of what you're doing. I think that your vision is awesome. I'm super excited for the game to come out on Greenlight. And I also just wanted to mention that this was actually part of a wave of like 100 games that got greenlit as like the anniversary for the Greenlight service.
That's awesome. He also tweeted asking us which episode of Zero Punctuation was the one with the transgender theme drama.
Excellent. I'm not going to repeat the slurs here, but Yahtzee from Zero Punctuation, and this was in the episode about the game Papers, Please, he did issue an apology to the
trans community,
and I felt that it was lacking, but I appreciated that he made some kind of effort. He changed one of the references in the episode. He did not change both of the verbal references, and he did not change the art assets that still use pejorative terms. And he defended his use of pejorative terms in a way that...
Gross.
While I don't agree with him, I understand why he thinks that's okay, even though I don't think it's okay.
I think it's gross.
So again, that's the Papers, Please episode. It was just a week or two ago, and it's still up. So, thank you so much for your feedback.
Yeah. Jeremy from Koopa Club tweeted, "Thanks for slaying me, GameBuoy.org." And he quoted my quote, "The only other notable mermaid-based gameplay I can remember is from Barbie." Unfortunately, Barbie did not have any sexy merman man pecs. Bubonic Clegg responded to a tweet that you had mentioned about the 2DS. Even before we kind of finalized the topic for this week's GameBuoy, you were saying, yeah, I anticipate that we'll be talking about it on GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
And, cause, you know, even if we hadn't talked about it in our, discussion, it was still gonna be news. And so, Bubonic Clegg on Twitter said, "And where exactly would we hear about that again? Is there an address or some such that's easy to remember?"
GameBuoy.org.
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 Oh man, we're like Pokemon. I'm like, GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy. GameBuoy.
BuoyBuoy.
BuoyBuoy. .org.
Okay, now we just sound like Furbies. Let's get it on. Go, go, go.
Waylo, uh-oh, me now.
Stop. Don't do what you're doing.
So, last but certainly not least, we got a lovely email from our friend Francisco Yu.
Thank you, Francisco. This email is super lovely. We are going to read it, but I just wanted to say, aside from all that, thank you so much. And, of course, thank you for mailing us.
MailBuoy@GameBuoy.org.
MailBuoy@GameBuoy.org. MailBuoy is super cute, and we really like when people email him.
Yes. So he says, "Dear Captain Spike and First Mate Slackick." Oh, he even said dear. "Caught up..."
It's a pretty standard salutation.
Yes, but he could have been like, "Hey, sluts." So, anyways, I'm going to start over and give this proper...
No, please do.
...attention it deserves. "Dear Captain Spike and First Mate Slackick, caught up this week with the podcast, and OMFG, I freaking love you guys. Thanks for singing the pizza song at the end of episode 34. Captain Spike, please let First Mate Slackick sing more often. It's magical. I know you want to stay on point, but I really enjoy the random singing. Hello, pirate saying all the times. Yo-ho-ho, and something about rum. Also, I don't have a problem with the length of the show. In fact, I really enjoy the show being long, because I find the discussions interesting, and now other podcasts seem too short. The first episode I listened to was the Rhythm Games episode, and I thought it was the norm to have an A and B side, and that the show was a good 5 hours long. Wow, I hope we don't let you down this week. Moving on to episode 35, for a Disney episode, there was not enough singing. NES, Chippendale, DuckTales, and Darkwing Ducks were like a trifecta of awesomeness. With regards to DuckTales Remastered, I dislike how they changed it, that in the Amazon, you don't move to the left. I felt that in the NES version, the world felt more open, because you had the option to go to the right and the left. And yes, I know it was because of the limitations why you went left. Why is it that odd to scroll left to right? Also, F*K them for taking away the hidden treasures in the African mines and moon." Right? That was the one disappointment I had.
No.
"And for taking away the shortcut in the African mines."
As soon as you finish this, we have breaking news. Something just happened at PAX.
Uh-oh. Okay, so we're gonna keep going. "Screw Mickey Mouse Capade because I never got past stage 2. Love the Lion King video game. Didn't play Aladdin, but I'm now interested in trying out both versions. One last thing. Captain Spike, it's cute how nerdy you are, and I don't see how it would stop you from never getting laid again."
I am so red right now.
"First Mate Sidekick never stops singing. Also, thank you for pronouncing Chito 16 correctly. Fun fact, the name was inspired by Chateau Romani from Zelda Majora's Mask, because I wanted a unique spelling for Chito.
That's awesome.
Keep it up, you guys, and I look forward to future episodes. Francisco Yu, a.k.a. Chito 16. Aww.
I want to say, Francisco, I will definitely be letting Slagkick sing more, possibly
fact,
sooner than you think.
Yeah, so stay tuned.
But, and again, thank you so much for all of your positive feedback. We obviously live for that. It's very hard for us to sort of see how we're doing. And when you guys encourage us to do certain things more or less, that helps us, you know, make a better show for all y'all.
And now we have breaking news.
Oh my God, I love that. So holy shit, at PAX just now, Keiji Inafune-san announced the spiritual successor to Mega Man. He is making an HD sprite-based side-scrolling game in the vein of Mega Man called Mighty No. 9.
Oh my God. You snooze, you lose, Capcom.
You are the ninth in a line of powerful robots, and the only one not infected by a mysterious computer virus. Run, jump, blast, and transform your way through 6 stages or more. You can tackle in any order you choose using enemy weapons and abilities stolen from your enemies. Like, straight up, this is an HD sprite-based Mega Man game. Like, Obviously, it is not literally Mega Man, but you look at it, and it is very clear immediately that is Mega Man.
Well, Capcom
every aspect, every aspect of development, art, level design, music, programming, etc., is being handled by veteran Japanese game creators with extensive experience in the genre, and with Mega Man in particular. Basically, Inafune-san has collected all of the people who are hell of into making Mega Man games, and is getting them to make this new game. This is being developed for PC, of course, with gamepad support. It's going to be made available through Steam and DRM-free digital distribution methods. And it's still more than a year off, unfortunately. And the part I hadn't gotten to yet, this is the part that's sort of just a little bit of a downer for me, but I'm not super worried about it. This is a Kickstarter.
Pledging.
It is going... They are already aiming for a worldwide release. And the studio, or a firm that Nintendo works with for translation, 8-4 Studios, not always, obviously, they have their internal treehouse, but, you know...
Some of those treehouse guys are hella cute, too.
They really are. But, like, of the two translation houses for video games that are most well-known, I would say 8-4 and Treehouse are the two. 8-4 is handling this game.
Wow.
They have confirmed
it. Are there any stretch
it.
Goals for other console releases?
Well, that's... The stretch goals so far... So it's starting off with 6 enemies. That's why they had said 6 enemies or more. That's via stretch goals. They want to make a bigger, longer game. They want, and you'll have to hold up for the briefest of moments because I'm still literally reading about all of this right now. This hit literally while, this was announced while we were recording. This Kickstarter page launched while we were recording this episode here this, Saturday afternoon. There's going to be a create a challenge stretch goal. You're actually doing the correct thing while I read this. Let's see. So 2 more stages, Mac Linux versions, New Game Plus and Turbo Mode, a super secret stretch goal that they don't want to reveal yet, a making of documentary, another stretch goal. And at $2.5 million, if they get that high, there will be PS3, 360, and Wii U versions.
Yes.
Their goal to get the game made is a significantly lower than that. $900,000.
I think they'll get that.
I think they will get it. I am literally watching, while I have been looking at this page, like 300 people have backed it.
And this is,
they're already past the 40, they're like past the $40,000 mark
already.
This
is a concept release, presumably.
He doesn't specifically cite, Project by Concept USA. That would be funny. He went from Capcom to Concept and now is making Mega Man replacements and spiritual successors.
Well, like we said, Capcom, you snooze, you lose.
Yeah,
I was hoping you had more to read so I could do the Bubble Man theme.
Why don't you just
do it? Na 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 na
na na na na na na na na na na na na na na na na na na na na na na na na na na na na na na na I literally just backed this game. I went for the
please send me a link.
Yeah, well, and we'll post a link to it on GameBuie.org.
GameBuie.org.
Aside from that, for our actual episode, and I apologize to our listeners, I'm kind of freaking out. You know, I talk here about how important Mega Man is to me all the time. It's actually even been more important to me of late. I've been talking a lot about Mega Man games and replaying Mega Man games and really reconnecting with, like, part of why I've been talking so much about classic games in the last few episodes is I'm really reconnecting with, like, my real pleasure in collecting games and playing retro games.
Yeah.
So, this is really exciting to me. A revival of this kind of game, that's exactly what I want.
That is what GameBuie is. Hashtag here for that.
And
if you're not, then cry about it. That was for you, Strawberry Wish.
All right. Is there anything else you need to say?
We love your feedback. We like your iTunes ratings and reviews, so, and your subscriptions. We like your Facebook. Facebook likes. We fucking love Twitter.
We love Twitter. We tweet so often. If you follow me, if you follow me on Twitter, I'm really sorry. My personal Twitter is at SpikePoint, and I tweet
personal Twitter
all day.
Is at SlideKick. And you can tumble with us on Tumblr, plus one us on Google+. Email mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org.
mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org.
And you can find all of these social links along with a complete episode archive back from the episode one at gamebuoy.org.
Gamebuoy.org. And you know, we don't often talk about our early pre-GameBuoy game podcast here. I know that a lot of other indie podcasters and broadcasters whom I know have episode zeros hidden that they talk about, oh, maybe someday we'll release that. Just so that you know, Slagkick, and I know you don't know this prior to me saying it here live on air, which is unfair of me, at some point I'm uploading those early episodes to the internet so that people can laugh at how awful we used to
be. Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
Please look forward to it.
Let's talk about some people who are not awful, who are actually rather amazing.
Well, obviously, the first show that comes to mind with that criteria would be Koopa Club. That is Koopa with a Q and Club with a K. If you like what we do and you're listening to this show, which obviously you are since you're hearing this, you definitely need to check these guys out. They're great. I really love what they do.
If no one listens to a podcast, does it still make noise?
People listen to this show, so I can't really ask that. I mean, I can't really answer that. Wait, are you telling me that our listener count is zero?
No, I'm just saying that, you know, like if a tree falls in the wood, doesn't make any noise. I'm saying that if people were not listening, does that mean that this podcast doesn't exist? That we're just speaking into the void?
Well, I mean, we would be speaking into the void, but you're hearing it as I'm saying
with
it.
With the Daleks!
So.
You know, the void.
I hate you. You're the worst. You are the literal worst.
Exterminate.
You know who else people should be listening to is VG Realness, serving up a weekly dose of gaming chit-chat among friends.
Video Game Realness, what?
They're an LGBT-centric show that, again, I think of Koopa Club and VG Realness both as, like, sister shows. You know, there's something, the hashtag sisterhood of indie gaming podcasts.
Sisterhood of the traveling pods.
Girl. I also want to shout out to Geek Charisma, a podcast that is everything geek with discussions on movies, DVDs, video games, conventions, and comics. And last, but most definitely not least, we have Orange Lounge Radio, OLR for short, where every gamer has a voice, and from whom I myself steal ever so many cues. Slagkick, what about you?
I steal my cues from Dark Sakura, although I can never be as fabulous and fierce as she is. I'd like to shout out to Game Bar, the podcast that fills your brain space with hours of
gaming. I'm sorry, who is that again?
I want to shout out to a Game Bar.
Oh, no, you stole it from me.
Yeah, because I knew you were going to interrupt me.
I want to take it to a Game Bar.
The podcast that fills your brain space with hours of gay video game commentary. They're basically the gay video game Prairie Home Companion. Nerdgasm Network.
I love that description.
Yeah, that they came up with that on the episode I guested on recently. Nerdgasm Network, which is the wildest shock video game radio show that you'll ever come across. And it's a bag of hot dicks. Girls Gone Wow, featuring our lovely friend Syl and her gals, where you can get a female perspective on the world's most popular MMO. Which, although it might be the world's second most popular if 14 and Realm Reborn keeps doing well. If you like hearing about A Realm Reborn...
That seems a little unlikely.
If you like hearing about A Realm Reborn and all other things online gaming, you should check out Horde House, the place for all things online gaming, but never too seriously, featuring the illustrious Rob Roberts from Orange Lounge Radio and Vogue Network, and Extifer, Grandpa, and Shane.
As ever and always, we will link you to all of these things on GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org, but I still have one more shout-out to...
But not to something that we're going to link to, which was my point in saying this before you got to that. So now say it.
Video Game Outsiders, the podcast about video gaming from the average player's perspective.
I'm wrong.
Yeah. And, like I said, Horde House, Girls Gone Wow, and OLR are all available on the Voice of Geeks Network, VogNetwork.com for short. So go participate live with Orange Lounge Radio. And the last shout out that we're doing that you were thinking that I was talking about was to Zelda Reorchestrated, May They Forever Sail the Great Seas. Anytime you hear that music when you're playing Wind Waker HD, you'll probably think of Game Boy now. Okay, that was really cocky of me, but thank you so much for tuning in. We love you. We love your feedback. We love our shout outs. We love Game Boy.
As ever and always, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for listening. We appreciate your attention. I know that we run a little long, but we love talking to all y'all out there. I hope you got something out of this episode. Until we meet again, keep gaming, keep thinking, and tabun yujo no tame ni.
Did you say Yu-Gi-Oh? Game Buoy. I kind of wonder how long it will take before someone tries to snap a picture of their genitals.
Oh, that looks like my junk. Might as well use my junk.
Might as well use my junk.
Might as well use my junk. My junk. My junk. My junk.
Chibi Robo, let's go photo.
What the hell is wrong with you, girl?
We are killing it. Yeah.
I got guests and a show. And I'm ready to go.
And I think that's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. Perfonus. So what? Hunky. Sexy merman man pecs. Look at this stuff. Isn't it neat? Wouldn't you think my collection's complete? Wouldn't you think I'm the girl who has everything? Look at this trove, treasures untold. How many wonders can one cavern hold? Looking around here, you think, sure, she's got everything. I've got gadgets and gizmos aplenty. I've got who's its and what's its galore. You want thingamabobs? I've got 20. But who cares? No big deal. I want more. I want to be where the people are. I want to see them dancing, walking around on those, what do you call them? Oh, feet. Flipping your fins, you don't get too far. Legs are required for jumping, dancing, strolling along on that spot. What's that word again? Street. Up where they walk, up where they run, up where they stay all day in the sun, wandering free. Wish I could be part of that world.
Oh my god, okay, stop, that's incredible.